Okay. Okay, I'm down here in the dark without a microphone. So my wireless mic isn't working, so I'm going to have to do it this way. Most appropriate because I went to a community medical school lecture last night on the human voice and how it works and what goes wrong with it and how to fix it. And one of the pieces of advice is, don't do this. So, that's why the mic isn't working today. It wants to see if it can really make me bruise my vocal cords. There's the information you always wanted. Monday. The exam here, the last third of the alphabet, O through Z. Goes to Fleming, 101. Everybody else comes here. Bring a number 2 pencil. The review sessions tonight, today, after class here, and Sunday at 7:30 in Living Learning 315. Same format as before. 50 multiple choice questions. Everything will relate to cognitive development, but some of the questions will ask you to connect it to biological development. 3 out of 4 essays. Essentially no time limit, but you didn't take all that much time last time, so we're safe. Questions about the exam or the review sessions? Yes. I'm sorry, my microphone isn't working, so I can't hear you. Whatever's on the syllabus. The pages that refer to intellectual development. Everything for Unit 2. You have found the syllabus, right? Yes. Okay, good. Other questions about the review or the exam? Okay. When last we met, we were looking at examples. This is the overhead that I had up last time, so not new. We were looking at examples that demonstrated the adolescent's developing ability to look at the set of possible combinations, as you did in the problem in the problem set with coins. And with the chemical combinations that we did at the end. We talked, and the text describes the process of using hypothetico-deductive logic. That means developing a hypothesis from your observations and then testing it by setting up an example that varies only by one critical element. And the important element here about hypothetico-deductive thinking and reasoning is that what the adolescent does is combine hypothesis generation with deductive logic. infants and toddlers generate hypotheses, but they can't test them using logic. Elementary school age children can generate hypotheses, but they can't test them systematically using deductive logic. So what's different in adolescence is the beginning of the ability to generate a hypothesis and then test it by looking at situations that vary only by one feature. Okay, so setting up a test that will, in fact, test the validity of your hypothesis is an adolescent accomplishment that we continue using through adulthood, and it is the basis of scientific thinking, that which they are trying to teach you in all your science courses. Adolescents become able to coordinate two or more different systems of reference. I illustrated that. To appreciate the similarities and dissimilarities of complex relationships. And that's the part that I wanted to jump to now. This was the task that we were doing on the board. I'm going to turn the light back on because I want to use the board for a minute. Okay. So this was the chemical problem that demonstrated that because you could follow it, that you were formal operational, you can do those kinds of problems. And the elements of that problem are that you can generate all the possible combinations of the four chemicals, and one at a time, two at a time, three at a time, and finally four at a time. You can generate hypotheses about what you're observing and test them. So you could figure out that if you wanted to demonstrate that the fourth chemical counteracted the reaction that created the orange color, then you could make the orange color using one and three, which were the two chemicals that produced that. And then if you added the fourth chemical to that combination that had already turned orange, then it would turn clear again. So by setting up that test, you demonstrated your ability to think hypothetico-deductively, to understand that the way to test that is to try to reverse that reaction and to vary only one thing at a time. Okay? So what we had was the four chemicals, all those possibilities, one and three made the orange when we added G to it, and two was neutral, and four inhibited or counteracted the reaction. So four was a counter agent. Now, I just said that I wanted to demonstrate to you that you could look at the similarities and dissimilarities of complex systems. So let me give you another complex system. This is the one you have already looked at on Monday. This system is not chemical. This system is people. We have Judy. And Alice. And Fred. And Planned Parenthood of Northern New England. No beakers of chemicals. Now we have three people and an organization made up of people. And instead of the catalyst with the eyedropper, this has a different kind of catalyst, sex. Everybody likes the examples with sex. So, what happens in this example is that Judy can have sex by herself. If you don't know how to do that, ask somebody. Alice can have sex by herself. Fred, and we know according to Kinsey that this is an almost universal experience. And I don't know if Planned Parenthood of Northern New England can have sex with itself. Any of you volunteer there, we'll discuss that, whether that can happen. Maybe, maybe not. If Judy and Alice have sex together, and if you don't know about that, we have a course that you can take for that one. They have fun. If Judy and Fred have sex, they have fun too. And sometimes, when they do, if they do it often enough, long enough, they get pregnant. Okay. And the test strip turns orange or something like that. If Alice has sex with... If Alice has sex with Fred repeatedly, different times, over a long enough period of time, they have a lot of fun, but there's no pregnancy. If Judy and Alice and Fred all have sex together often enough, occasionally there's a pregnancy that happens in that combination. If Judy and Fred make use of the services of Planned Parenthood of Northern New England, they don't get pregnant. If Judy and Alice and Fred make use of the services of Planned Parenthood of Northern New England, no pregnancies happen. Okay? You've got the system? How does it compare to the chemical combinations problem that we looked at Monday? Any similarities? How many of you see some similarities? Okay, what are the similarities? Okay, so you have four elements, two of them together cause a reaction, okay. A change, the pregnancy. Is that the same, is it really similar? Is it the same pattern? It's the same form. Is it isomorphic? It's basically the same form. And you can see that similarity in the form. Right? Is it exactly the same form? No. How come? What's different? Okay, the content is clearly different. That's clear. The content is different. What else is different? Oh, wait a minute. If you add four to the pregnancy, is it not going to reverse the reaction? Why isn't it? Will it? What?
Without modern morning after pills?
Planned Parenthood provides contraceptive services to keep the reaction from happening, but Planned Parenthood also provides pregnancy termination. So they will, in fact, make the reaction go away. They'll make the pregnancy disappear. So in that way, it really is the same. It's both preventive and counteractive. I don't know what word I wanted to use. Okay. Are there other ways that it's not parallel? It's not exactly the same form? One, two, three, and four in the chemical problem were all colorless liquids. So they were essentially the same form. They were different chemicals, but they were all the same sort of element. What about Judy, Alice, Fred, and Planned Parenthood? Is Planned Parenthood the same kind of element? No. It's not a person. It's an organization. And it provides services through the, probably through the auspices of one particular person at a time. But it's an organization, it's not an individual. So in that way, the parallel is not exact. It's not exactly isomorphic. What do we know, by the way, about Judy? She's fertile. Okay. And she gets into the pregnant state. What do we know about Alice? She seems to be sterile. Fred? Yeah? He's a guy. Right? We know about that, right? We don't deal in stereotypes here. We also might describe Judy and Alice, since I suggested that they have sex together and with Fred, they might, if we need to categorize them, be bisexual in their sexual orientation. Okay? The parallel enough? Yeah. But it's not quite exact. What your formal operational skills allow you to do is to take those two complex systems and see where they are similar and how they're similar, and where and how they are different. And that is a significant component of adolescent and adult thinking. Finding those abstract systems that are and are not isomorphic. Let me give you some other examples of how that plays out in our thinking. One is in the kind of thing that we do to you in college. We give you compare and contrast questions. And when you have a question that asks you to compare and contrast complex systems, they're asking about the isomorphism and the non-isomorphism. Contrasting means finding where they're different. Comparing means find where they're the same. And talk about those. So this might be an exam question in an introductory philosophy course. It's similar to one I had in college. So you have compare and contrast Plato's theory of truth to Aristotle's theory of truth. They both dealt with how do you know something is true. But they went about describing it in different ways. They went about developing different ways to demonstrate that something is true or false. And this question says, you need to understand each of those systems well enough that you can tell me how they're the same. How did they go about it in the same way? And how are they different? What distinguishes their two points of view? And we expect people to be able to handle that kind of question as they enter at late adolescence. College is full of those. Here are some others. These are uses of that skill that begin to show up, some of them in early adolescence. The notion of a simile, when you say, my love is like a red, red rose. Remember this from eighth grade? They tried to teach you the difference between metaphor and simile and analogy. Metaphor and simile and analogy are all about similarity and dissimilarity of complex systems. They're all about isomorphism and non-isomorphism. So if something is a simile, it's, you use like or as, so you're pointing it out. And here, one of the systems is my love. This is a poem by Browning. I think Browning. Right? First line. English major, quick. Who wrote the poem? My love is like a red, red rose. Must be Browning. If nobody knows, it was Browning. But don't put that on your English exam or you're in trouble. So one side of this analogy, or this simile in this case, is my love. So we need to figure out what the poet means by my love. Is the poet talking about the person she loves? Is the poet talking about the process of love? The state of love? The act of love? We don't know. We better figure that out at some point. And the other side of the analogy is a red, red rose. Now, how is the rose like my love? We need to read the rest of the poem. I don't have it here and I don't know it. Anybody have the whole poem memorized? No, you don't. Okay. The analysis of the simile is, in what ways does the poet demonstrate that her love is like a red, red rose? In what way are they isomorphic, and which ways are they not? For the poem to be successful, it has to spell out the isomorphism. How are they alike? And much of poetry is based on simile. Some of it is based on metaphor. We already talked about that. When the cat's away, the mice will play is isomorphic with any situation in which you have that hierarchy in the system and the presence of the dominant figure inhibits the naturally occurring undesirable behavior of the subordinate figure. All the way through the sentence. Hey, not bad. Okay. Symbolism. What does a writer mean when she says, storm clouds are gathering over the treaty discussions? Does that mean they'd better put up their umbrellas? Because it's going to rain on their parade? Okay. Our speech, our language, is full of examples where we describe something in a symbolic way. We describe things using metaphor. Our ability to do that depends on recognizing isomorphism. It depends on being able to compare one set of relationships with relationship that has a different content and to see where they're similar. Children have a lot of trouble with symbolism. But as we get up into adolescence, we begin to get fascinated by that. We start writing symbolic poetry, symbolic stories. We like those things. Irony. Irony depends on recognizing that two relationships, or a relationship that you express, in fact doesn't apply. It's the opposite of the intended meaning. So there you are under the storm clouds, it's raining on you, and you're saying, beautiful weather, eh? Like that. It works only if you recognize the oppositeness, the non-isomorphism, and you enjoy that. You say something like that to a child who's getting soaking wet, and the kid looks at you like you're crazy, because the child doesn't understand that the non-isomorphism is in fact a form of humor. Sarcasm. Ah, here comes the beautiful princess, fresh from her refreshing sleep, says your father the morning after when you come down looking like something the cat dragged in. He's being sarcastic. Hypocrisy. This is one that adolescents thrive on. Children don't recognize hypocrisy. Adolescents begin to find it everywhere. Hypocrisy depends on non-isomorphism. The word even says. Have you ever thought about what the word means? It's not hypocrisy like democracy, no matter how often you spell it that way. The word literally is hypocritical. Not enough. Logic. When you are being hypocritical, you are not creating isomorphism between what you say and what you do. Or you are applying different standards, again, a non-isomorphism, to two different situations. You're talking out of both sides of your mouth. You're saying two different things and pretending they mean the same thing when they don't. So recognizing that somebody is being a hypocrite requires that you be able to see the non-isomorphism. And adolescents become able to see that. And they thrive on finding it. And probably, fortunately for them and unfortunately for the rest of us, they find it everywhere. Because hypocrisy surrounds us. You remember when you began to stumble over it? And the adults in your life began to have clay feet? Remember? Examples? Some of the hypocrisy you discovered. Anybody got an example to share? Don't have sex before you get married. That's not hypocrisy.
Well, it is because everyone that I knew at the time.
All they're doing is telling you that they had sex and it messed up their lives, and now they're passing on the good experience to you, right? That's not hypocrisy. Oh, it might be. Okay. A little bit. The parents would rather think it's not hypocrisy. They're just passing on their bad experience. But if you ask them if they had sex before marriage and they say no, then you know you've got them. Okay. Hypocrisy often is of the form, don't do as I do, do as I say. If you're being logical, then what you say matches what you do. Basic logic. Isomorphism. And our hypocrisies often are when we do things that are contrary to what we say. Other examples? All right, don't smoke. It's bad for you. While they're smoking. Yeah, that's the don't do it. Or take me as a great example and don't follow me. That could be good advice. But not if it comes with the you shouldn't smoke because you're young and it'll hurt you, but I'm old and it won't hurt me. It's not dangerous for me because I'm old and Other examples? When parents treat boys, that never happened in your families, did it? How many of you have siblings of the other gender? How many of you had parents who treated you exactly the same? You can't see down here. All the hands went down. Did any of you have parents who were successful at non-sexist parenting? I see. Your generation has a heck of a challenge. Wait a minute. How many of you believe that parents should treat boys and girls the same? Okay, there are a few. Okay, you who believe that have a major challenge ahead of you. That's one that really galls you, particularly if you're on the short end of the comparison. And that's a common one. It's one that often hits us in adolescence. Because one of the problems in families is that as boys become adolescent, parents often decrease their surveillance and control. And when girls hit puberty, they often increase. The literature is very consistent on that, that parents become more protective of daughters than of sons as they enter puberty. And, I mean, the reasons are obvious, probably, because you can get much more for a virgin when you sell her than you can for a non-virgin. So, you wanna... Well, in some cultures, they sell daughters. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. The example is the family that really wants to do it right and makes the girls mow the yard, rake the leaves, shovel snow, makes the guys set the table, do the dishes, help with the cooking, vacuuming, making beds, all that internal stuff. Good. You can do that too. And some of you want to find out, if you don't already know, that person you're dating, you want the guy from that family, right? Because otherwise you get a guy who doesn't know anything about doing anything in the house. Okay, what happens when you're finding the hypocrisy is that you're applying that abstract intellectual skill that begins to click in during adolescence. And that use of cognitive skills begins to create problems. Because how many of you had parents who really loved it when you pointed out that they were being hypocrites? How many of you had teachers who really loved it when you questioned their logic? At what point did you figure out that school had a set of goals? They're going to teach you. This was one of my awakenings in adolescence. The school had a mission statement about what it was doing to us. It was going to treat us to operate in a democratic society. And I began to wonder where we were going to get to practice being in a democratic society. Because school sure as heck wasn't it. Because the principal had veto power on just about everything the student council tried to do. So it was a sham. It wasn't democracy. When did I get to choose my teachers? When did I get to choose my courses? When did I get to participate in self-evaluation or grading? When did I get to vote on anything that was really important? Didn't happen. Didn't happen. When did I get to face a panel of my peers when I screwed up? No, I faced the principal who wasn't interested in my defense. He was interested in sending me home because I wasn't following the dress code. This wasn't hypocrisy. It was just one of those wonderful examples of an adult's inability to think. Yeah. Great principle. I mean, great big principle. He wasn't... I didn't say that. But I worked in a men's clothing store in high school. And one afternoon, the predecessor of UPS came up and dumped boxes on the loading dock. I unpacked them, and here were these absolutely wonderful khaki-colored and green, just like this, Continental chino pants. Peg leg, ooh, nice. Belt in the back, no belt loops, really trim. And I could wear them then, too, because I was really trim. And I bought two pair. Went home, my mother was thrilled. Get me out of blue jeans. Yes, finally. Went to school. Between first and second period, principal passed me in the hall, said, wait a minute. Stop right there. Where's your belt? He said, that's not a belt. The dress code says you have to wear a belt. I said, it doesn't have any belt loops. He said, go home and put on pants with a belt. I went home. My mother laughed. My father said, I think I'll run for the school board. And he did later, after I graduated. And I went back to school wearing my blue jeans and with an opinion of the principal's intelligence that had gone from here to... And it hit the floor later when he threatened to expel me again for not singing at graduation. One would think I would be expelled for singing. No, he was going to expel me for not singing. He wasn't going to give me my diploma. Why? Because he had said he wanted two of my friends to sing with me a trio of his favorite song, The Hallowed Halls of Ivy, at commencement. We said, sure. The music teacher couldn't find a trio arrangement, decided Connie and Pat should sing it as a duet. That was fine. We rehearsed it. We went on. 3 or 4 days before commencement, he asked me how the rehearsals were going, how the song was. I said, oh, they're doing a great job. And he said, what do you mean, they? I said, well, I'm not doing it. He looked at me and said, yes, you are. Well, you know, what's the big deal? No, you're singing. Why? Because it's already in the program. Ah. He wanted isomorphism. If the program said it was a trio, then by golly, it had better be a trio. He was stuck on that isomorphism. I was willing to be flexible and non-isomorphic. He was willing to let me do that and not be a high school graduate. I didn't sing. I got my diploma. I guess he backed down. I don't know who talked to him, but maybe the music teacher. Then there was this other one that was important to me as I sat in church every day, every Sunday, not every day. No, every Sunday. That was enough. And I listened as a child and learned to recite a creed. It's a Protestant Reformed church, Presbyterians. So it was a creed that we learned to recite, what we believe. And as I got to be an adolescent, I understood what we were saying. And what I discovered was that there were people around me in church who were reciting that creed about what they said on Sunday. And then they were doing their business on Monday. And sometimes the non-isomorphism was pretty clear. But what they said on Sunday didn't match what they said on Monday, what they did on Monday. And you wondered, they're missing something. That ability causes kids to begin to question their elders. And when we start questioning our elders as adolescents, often we're not very polite about it. We haven't learned that yet. So we're often pretty direct. Why do you believe that stupid stuff, Dad? I don't. I'm not going to church anymore. That kind of thing comes up with adolescents fairly often. It's based on their ability to question, to apply logic. And our reaction to that kind of criticism and questioning ought to be, oh yes, great, the kid's becoming an adult thinker. He's carving me up, but he's becoming an adult thinker. And that should be the response in schools when kids start questioning why they have to take this, that, and the other thing, why they have to do it this way. All of those questions reflect the kid's ability to understand a bigger scheme and to look for the isomorphisms and to reason about it. Well, if you believe this, then you probably ought to be doing this, and if you're doing that, that implies that kind of logic becomes common in adolescence and ought to be celebrated and encouraged rather than shot down, which is what adults often do with it. Okay. I have another example I'm going to save for the next unit. So what's happening in adolescence is that kids are becoming able to think like their parents. They don't have the same content. They don't have the same experience. And we'll look at how the intellectual development continues after adolescence. But the key in Piaget's theory, the key element is that when you finish developing formal operational reasoning, you are at the same level as the adults logically. You are now an adult. You are able to think abstractly. You're able to look at complex schemes, put them together, and transform them in logical ways. Then you go to college. And hopefully we don't undo all that. We hopefully consolidate it and give you a lot of opportunity to practice. One of the people described in the textbook, or the work described in the textbook, is by a man named Bill Perry, who studied college students most of his life, his career, including a number of years spent trying to understand what it is that happens from the time people go to college until they graduate. How does the experience change you intellectually? It doesn't give you any particularly new logic, as Piaget suggested. Once you get the formal operations pretty well down and consolidated, that's where you are, and that's where you're going to stay. But how you use them and what you expect in courses and of faculty changes. And what Perry describes is that sometime in high school, as you get really good with formal operational reasoning, you're in a state, a belief system that he calls dualism. The logical skills that adolescents develop make it possible for them to figure out the right answers as long as they stay logical within the system that they're looking at, whether that system is chemistry or mathematics or English literature, the study of economics. You have problems and you ought to be able to solve them. And typically that's true. And high schools tend to reinforce that belief that if you just think clearly and logically enough and powerfully enough, you'll come up with the right answers. And some people get over that in high school. Some of them bring that notion to college and they're looking for the right and wrong answers, and they tend to think about black and white rather than shades of gray. And the way we see that in college, for example, in introductory courses, never here, well, actually sometimes here in HDFS 5, but in other courses where people come to college, they're spending all this money, they're supposed to learn to be thinkers, and they're learning to be smart, and they're supposed to learn stuff, and the faculty ought to be able to tell them what to learn, how to learn it, and what the answers are. Okay. Simple enough. And first-year students, not all, but some, get really ticked off with the fact that faculty won't tell them what the answers are. That faculty often are asking students to construct the answers themselves. And sometimes faculty even say things like, they don't know. Students ask really good questions in class. Faculty member says, I don't know. It's a great question. You begin to wonder, why do they pay this guy? He doesn't know anything. He doesn't know the things I want to know. So you reject him because he doesn't have the answers. One of my very favorite examples from this course, I was reminded of this morning. Dale Goldhaber and I used to team teach this course. So we would both be present, and we would occasionally lecture on the same topic from our different viewpoints. And one of them, I'll never forget, we thought it was wonderful when we finished. We thought it had been a great presentation and discussion with the students. And what happened was we wanted to illustrate in marriage, partnerships, in adulthood, one of the issues that couples have to work out is the division of labor. And if you're trying to be egalitarian, as treat each other as equals, you ought to be dividing the work in some way that makes sense. So I described how my wife and I, who thought we were egalitarian and equals, had done that at that particular time in our lives, which was she stayed home, took care of the kids in the house, and I came out here and did my thing, and I brought home the money, and it belonged equally to us, and we both shared as many of the experiences we could, but our choice was a very traditional set of roles. And we were happy with that at the time I made that, gave that part of the lecture. Dale and his wife had decided to split all the chores in half because they were both working full time. So one of them shopped one week, the other one shopped the other week, the next week. One of them vacuumed this week, the other one vacuumed next week. They split childcare in half. Okay. So they did it by literally dividing the world life in two. And Dale and I respected each other's approach. We had, with our wives, discussed the differences. Both couples were happy with that at the time. So we described these as two different ways to deal with the issue of egalitarianism in relationship. And we were rather surprised when we got the course evaluation that three or four students had commented on the fact that we were very bad teachers because we disagreed. And they gave that example and a couple of others where we had presented different ways of doing things, different options, and the students wanted to know which is the right way, which is the wrong way. One of them has to be wrong. Two people who differ can't both be right. That's the position of dualism. Two people who differ can't both be right. One of them's got to be wrong, one of them has to be right. What happens during college is that people give that notion up and they become multiplicitous. There may be several different answers, but eventually one of them will be correct. Multiple as in multiple choice, I think. Several different possible answers, and right now Dale and Larry do this differently, but eventually we will figure out that one of them was wrong. We just don't know how to do that yet. So there comes a period during college when people spend their time trying to understand the different options, but still looking for the someday when one of them will be proven to be right. By the time people leave, we become relativistic. Take 4 years of courses, you're going to run into a number of situations where you're going to discover that there may in fact be more than one right answer, depending on the perspective. What we expect to have happen across the college years is that you learn to analyze the differences, to apply different critical stances to them, and be able to choose the critical stance that is appropriate for the particular content. And to understand that, in fact, there may not be one particular right answer. There may be several theories of cognitive development. There may be several theories of microeconomics. There may be several marketing strategies. There may be several accounting systems, some of which work for big businesses and some of which work better for small businesses. So we try to broaden the context of your thinking. And Perry describes that across different kinds of colleges, across different kinds of majors, both males and females, people are essentially giving up the notion that there is one right answer in favor of understanding that the world is typically full of very complex situations and systems. And the task is to understand them as well as you can in their complexity and be able to figure out what might work better in one situation than in another. Then we give you your degree and call you educated. The text describes a couple of other theories I just want to comment on. One that it spends a fair amount of time with is the work of K. Warner Shaya. Shaya is a developmental psychologist who has done major work in several different areas over his life. Now, we have a complex system here. I can let you see that last line either by moving the projector in or out. Could do that. But there's another way to do it. It's a complex system. And part of being an educated person is figuring out that you don't have to always do it the same way. I'll get there someday. Okay. K. Warner Shaya has studied cognitive development, intellectual development in adults for many, many years, and the text describes both his stage theory from childhood and adolescence through old age, and it also describes his work in the Seattle Longitudinal Study. I'll talk about that in a minute. The Seattle Longitudinal Study of intellectual development in adulthood is one of the most significant pieces of research that we have about what happens to our thinking as we get older. But where Shaya started is that he said what we are looking at is, again, not change in the logic that we use, but in our recognition of what's important. What are you using your intelligence for? And what is your attitude toward the use of your mind? That's what he was trying to describe. How do people change what they use their minds for across adulthood? And he says, we start off acquiring the skills that will earn us a living. And we learn to think so that we can get along in the world. And then that gradually gives way to using our thinking to achieve something. It's not just getting a job, but using your thinking, learning things, acquiring new skills so that you can achieve in that job or in some other chosen field that you would like. And then in some time in middle age, we use our intellect and learn new things because we have responsibilities. And it's the responsibilities, the specific responsibilities we have of parenting, of work, of civic duty, whatever it is that we're responsible for, that drives our decisions about what to learn, what to read, what to find out about. And people in middle age often describe doing something educational so that they can fulfill obligations and responsibilities, so that they can carry out their responsibilities. He calls that the executive function. My responsibility is not just to do something, but to figure out what to do. Being able to learn the things that you need to learn to figure out how to change the world. And as he often points out, you can be both responsible. You can be doing things for both of these reasons, responsibility and executive requirements during middle age. So they're not necessarily exclusive. Then later in life, particularly as we approach the time when we ought to be thinking about retirement, whether we are or not, people are often using their intellectual skills to reorganize their lives, to adapt to changes, to decide what it is that they would like to do next. And often then you find people going back to school. We don't have examples in here, very many anyway, of people who've come back to school in late middle age, but we often have people in this and other courses who have decided they need to know something new. Yes? I'm sorry. The executive is using your mind in order to figure out what to do. So it's the difference between having a responsibility and having the responsibility to figure out what you and other people ought to do. So it's the decision process. And in some ways, one way to think about it is the difference, if you're in business, you know, the difference between a manager and an executive. A manager carries out responsibilities defined by the executive. The executive sets the policy. The executive figures out what the company or the team ought to do. So the executive is a decision maker. The responsible person or the manager carries out the decisions. That's the distinction he's making. A little later in life, people are often coping with change in their abilities, change as they're doing something new. They've reorganized their lives and now they're trying to reintegrate, and that includes coming to terms with one's own mortality, with one's own future, with one's own lack of future, and spending more time thinking about the meaning of life, the meaning of your life. More reading on philosophical topics in many cases. And sometimes that happens because people's circumstances have changed. They now have the leisure, the freedom, the time, the opportunity to become more philosophical. But they're also driven toward trying to understand the why of things because they're approaching the end of their own lifespan. And then finally, the legacy creating use of your intellect is to leave something behind. The legacy is what you leave behind. And often people turn to writing their memoirs leaving a record of what they've done, making sense out of their experience that they can pass on to other people. And it's fascinating to me. I wish I had figures, but I don't. I don't know anybody who's done research. But if you look at the number of people who write their first article or their first monograph or their first book when they are over 80, it's a very significant number of people who decide that they want to leave something for their children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, society in general. And they begin to write. They sometimes write letters to the editor. They write poetry. They write essays. They write observations. And I have a nice example of that in, again, referring to Mom. Mom turned 90 a couple of years ago, and my cousin, her nephew, sent her a nice card and said, "When are you going to write your memoirs?" He's the family historian. He said, "When are you going to write your memoirs?" She looked skeptical and said, "I'm not going to write my memoirs." And I said, "Why not?" And she'd never written anything more than a letter or Sunday school lesson. And a couple of days later, I stopped by and she had written. She'd filled several pages of the story of her childhood and eventually brought it up. I think it typed out to about 8 or 10 pages, and then she started going through her photo albums and picking pictures from her childhood and adolescence that would illustrate her memoirs. Okay. That's the legacy creating. Something to leave behind that says, "I was here. And this is what I did. This is who I was." So, let me comment very briefly on what happens in something like the longitudinal research. If you give people tests, and the text, the Papalia text describes these studies, so I'm just going to highlight a few of them. What you find is that some skills decline. Okay, they're starting about my age. I don't think I'll talk about this. Anyway, start about my age. Things start to decline a little bit. Well, some things start to decline a little bit. Some things don't really. And what Shai and others have pointed out is that different kinds of thinking change across adulthood at different rates. And I probably have several examples. Here's a general illustration, which is that some skills, if you start down in childhood, keep on going up. And some skills begin to decline. Remember the physical changes that we saw decline. Well, intellectual skills aren't exactly like that, because some skills decline and some don't. And what the text describes from this research is that what researchers have come to do is label the skills that don't decline as crystallized. They mean is they're solid. They stay with you. And they stay with you because they're based on what you've already learned. And until your memory goes, you've got those. You've got that information. You can use that information. Other skills are called fluid because they drain away. And those are the skills typically that are based on the intactness of your brain and practice. The most of the skills that decline in adulthood are skills that people don't practice. If you keep practicing them, you're likely to hang on to them longer, as long as your brain stays intact. The text describes a pretty complex set of characteristics of the fluid and the crystallized skills. But I want to point out that what is crystallized and what is fluid is determined by whether or not it remains or whether it drains away. It's an empirical definition. If it declines in most people, then it's a fluid skill. If it doesn't decline in most people, then it's a crystallized skill. And then we try to explain how those things hang together. Why do the things that drain away drain away? Now, one other thing I want to illustrate in my 4 minutes is an important concept that the text describes, which is the difference between looking at skills cross-sectionally. In a cross-sectional study, you take people of different ages and you measure their skill and you plot it. And often, if you take a cross-sectional sample, you see a decline. And that used to make us think that intellectual skills generally declined across adulthood. But what Shai did was to take longitudinal studies where he gave the same people the same test over 20 or 30 or 40 years. And if you do that and plot their scores, they're more likely to look like that. Interesting question. Why would that be? Well, if you're looking at individual people, they're not likely to get stupider or less capable. If you're looking at people who are different ages, you have several differences, one of which, because they're in different cohorts, you're actually measuring people who had different levels of education. If you're 70, that means you went through school 60 years ago, and you're less likely, or you're likely to have gone less far in school than somebody who is now 30. So the 30-year-olds have had more education than the 70-year-olds. So if you went back to the 70-year-olds, you'd probably find that they were here, not here, because the age differences are confounded by the time of measurement differences. So one final piece. Another reason that studies tend to show the decline is that even if you take the individual in a longitudinal study, you're likely to find a change at the end of life. And this drop is called the terminal drop. Terminal means end, and it's an end-of-life drop. And what happens even in the longitudinal studies is that if you're giving a person the same test over time, you're likely to see a sudden drop in scores. And that has been discovered to be the predictor of biological decline, or the index of biological decline that's taking place in the brain. So people decline as they begin to get sick. If you take those people out, then you see less change across adulthood. if you see it, then you can begin to figure out, okay, something's wrong medically here. Something's wrong biologically. And what's going on in the brain is reflected in the test scores. And we'll stop there.